and welcome. I am your sometimes co-host of Flyover State of Fear, sometimes co-host Flyover State of Film, and your host, co-host today with my good friend Yousef on something that I pitched be called like flying elbow drop off the top rope of film, but will probably be called something like Flyover State of Fear special presentation. Welcome, Yousef. Hey, buddy, man. Good to see you. How you doing?
Hey, I'm alive. You know, I'm just excited. Back when I quit, I feel like a true wrestler. Like, I quit the business, but they offered me, like, you know, this is a special run. Just bring your character back. We'll give you a short window.
We'll do a limited run.
Some cool matches, and then you can go back. You can go back home. And I was like, all right,
We'll pitch you against a titan of the industry. I mean, you'll do a couple cities. We'll do like a Mega Powers thing, and then we'll just bail out.
Who's the one wrestler you really wanted to fight?
Would you come out of retirement for? Who is your greatest rival?
Ooh.
What? The supplemental viewing here.
Supplemental was Beyond the Mat.
Yeah, Dark Side of the Ring.
Dark Side of the Ring. Sorry, yeah.
No, I watched that too. I tried to get in as much Bret Hart content as I could. Ladies and gentlemen, if you didn't tell by the thing that you clicked on, I love when podcasts do this. Hey, better tell you what we're doing today. Surely you didn't read it in the description or anything. Dirt.
No.
Anyway, you're here watching two friends who want to talk about some wrestling documentaries. This is something I pitched to Yousef because, as you might know from previous shows we've done on wrestling topics, we both are longtime fans. Yousef, you were you came up kind of in the era of around the time of this movie, right?
Yeah. I remember watching this match. I was maybe 9-10 years old.
Okay.
Which was kind of, I should save it for later, but I feel like I was very shocked because, like, in my distant memory and all the clips and things that you see from the match, I thought it was vintage Shawn Michaels, not DX Shawn Michaels. So this, when they ramped it up during the documentary, I was like, fuck, this is not, like, because he was in his tights. And
yeah, you don't think of, well, I think it is, yeah, like, you don't think of Bret Hart being in the DX Attitude Era.
Yeah.
You don't feel like he lasted that long. You kind of think of him as, like, being more in, like, the end of the, you know, the end of the Hulk Hogan era. But yeah, no, he lasted. And we'll talk about, because that's a lot of what this movie is about, is the changing business and the passing torch. And that's a lot of the documentaries we picked for this. I, like Yousef, watched when I was younger. Now, when I was younger, it was like the era that's on my shirt, the Hulk Hogan, Ultimate Warrior, Macho Man. And then I got back into it, but actually a little bit after this, I was just slightly behind the Montreal Screwjob stuff. Like, I think I started watching again when Shawn Michaels was out with his injury and DX became Hunter and, you know, the Outlaw, New Age Outlaws and those guys. So that's right around the time I kind of picked back up with it. So I kind of learned about all this retroactively, and a lot of it is because of the documentary we're going to talk about today and some of the other ones we're going to touch on later in our little miniseries here. Yeah. So let's talk about today's movie a little bit. It's Hitman Hart, Wrestling with Shadows.
Yeah, I've actually never seen it before. So
no, you've never seen this. So it's not only, I was surprised, we both watched Dark Side of the Ring. I was surprised that they acknowledged the doc and used footage from it in that. I was like, oh, okay, they are going to get into that, because we'll talk about later, but I think this documentary actually serves a pretty important purpose in this whole story. But basically, this is a documentary that was being made around the time. It was basically about Bret Hart. It was supposed to be about, like, Bret Hart's kind of transition from the WWE to WCW, or, like, maybe just, it's hard to tell from what's here what it was started out as.
I feel like this documentary perfectly fits into the conspiracy theories. I know that Kevin Nash mentions the conspiracy theories. No, Scott Hall, sorry.
Scott Hall does too. Yeah. Yes, I think Kevin Nash is too, though. Like, I think I saw a thing on YouTube where he was talking about it also.
Because it's so perfectly convenient, but there's a lot of documentaries that just stumble on gold like this. Like, yeah. We happen to be, like, I know it's completely different, but, like, one of the Kelsey brothers was so happened to be taping a documentary, and it ended up being this massive thing about, the only brothers to be in a Super Bowl, blah, blah, blah. And it suddenly, like, the documentary shifted the narrative into, it's not about his retiring anymore, it's about this blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, it's not clear specifically because he's not hinting that he's going to retire.
No, not really.
And he's very conflicted about leaving as well, so I don't know what was the...
It's hard to tell what the initial pitch was, but like you said, they struck gold because they happened to hit on a very pivotal time in the business and a pivotal time in Bret Hart's career. So you said you've never seen this before, but the Montreal Screwjob is like the most talked about, the most covered wrestling event of the 20th century, probably.
It's really up there for sure.
Outside
of the tragedies in terms of like deaths, this is definitely the and the buying of WCW. You know how it completely collapsed.
We'll definitely be talking about the Monday Night Wars because actually, a lot of our stuff is from right around that era. We are going to touch on a little bit of the 80s stuff too, but I agree. But I mean, like, even as far as like a singular event that really like changed the business, this is one that sticks out for wrestling fans, and it's definitely something that's been covered a lot and been talked to death. So but I did like you've never seen it. I assume a lot of people haven't. So this documentary, along with the one we're going to do next time, Beyond the Mat, were the two that kind of broke through what kayfabe was, like what helped me understand the business of wrestling, which is really what has fascinated me most about wrestling since then. You know what I mean? I still kind of like tacitly follow it a little bit here and there, but I'm really interested in like the business and the way the secrecy of the business cultivated this like long history of crazy stories that were never told. And then you come to find out like shows like Dark Side of the Ring start to expose like all these different insane things that happen.
Oh, wild. Like I was watching it during like, there was like this cold front in Texas and we're just bunkering down because we didn't know if it was actually going to be bad outside or whatever. And I just watched like 5 episodes in a row. It is just so compelling to just keep clicking play after play, and it's
a well-made show. But plus, the stories are so interesting. They kind of have their. It's much like wrestling; it's sports and entertainment. So you have the idea of like athletics, but also kind of a true crime element to something. Vibes to them and stuff.
And it helps that they have like big names actually willing to sit down and tell the story.
Basically, anybody who's not still affiliated with the WWE will sit down. That's who they can get. Usually, if they're still under contract,
and the asshole Vince Russo.
Oh yeah, got Vince Russo and Jim Cornette.
Sucks.
They both are a couple of pieces of shit.
I'm fine with Jim Cornette being an asshole because at least he's an entertaining asshole.
Yeah, that's
Vince Russo is just boring as fuck, and he's just a pathological liar, and it's just I can't stand him.
Yeah, absolutely. We don't have to, hit every scene and talk about
it. I have so much to talk
about. Oh, good, good. I have plenty of notes, but I wanted to see.
I was working while I was watching this, so I legit used my work, my office to take.
He's got post-its.
Notes. Yeah. I was, at first I was like, fuck, this documentary is going to suck. Because the opening music.
Well, it's an old school documentary. Yeah. You don't realize you live in a golden era of produced documentaries. Yeah,
no. I know.
You watch something that was made in like 98 or 99,
The opening music, it was very weird. The PowerPoint presentation font.
There's a lot of music choices in this whole thing.
Yo, super. The one where he's like working out in the photo shoot, I was like, what the fuck is happening here? It's a weird characterization of, I don't think it's a characterization because it's actually him, but like he's like when I go to India, it's like they're watching a god. And I was like, ooh, am I going to hate Brett Favre? Brett the Hitman Brett Fart.
I do like the part where they say the kids called them Heart Fart. Harrison and
Joel. Yeah. But then suddenly, like, it started, like, just going bull rush forward through all of my favorite wrestlers, like, actually touching on backstage stuff, like Goldust not actually being a homosexual, Vader having a real estate license, Mankind being one of his favorites, which was an awesome, like, shout out.
I love him talking about the old school style of heels too, where, like, you know, this guy's a crazy monster, you know. Yes. Hunter, or Goldust and Hunter, they talk about Hunter gets heat by being an aristocrat, and back then he's better than everyone. Goldust does it through homophobia, basically. He's like a character to make homophobes uncomfortable. Exactly. Legendary son
which is why he works so well. Like, he's honestly incredible, so character compelling.
And so ahead of his time. I'm a big Goldust fan. Love Goldust.
I used to love him as a kid. I didn't know what it was, though.
I just loved that it was weird. He was like a Hollywood diva. And I also, it's funny, like, this is a sidebar, but it's so funny to be like, Goldust was gay. Look how he dressed. I was like, he wore the same exact thing as Ric Flair. Like, literally, they had the same robe. Like,
the same robe.
Oh, this one's gay. This one's the studliest dude ever.
This one's straight. Yeah, this one's straight. And another thing that when my eyebrow went up, because I watched the Hulu series first, the Vice series first,
sure,
is when he mentions Sonny, because there was like a little bit of a, and she's like all over him, and I'm like, ooh.
Yeah, we can talk, we'll talk a little bit about it as we get more into the depth, but it's very funny the things that are left out of this documentary that are in some of the supplemental
stuff. They really do supplement each other very well.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
They don't paint the full picture, obviously, because we'll never get the full picture, and there's a lot of, like, hearsay, and then we have liars like Vince Russo trying to shift the narrative, but the actual meat of it outside of the business that I found very compelling was his father. And that dynamic was very weird.
You're touching on a lot of stuff here, because I think a great place to start is just to talk a little bit about Bret Hart.
I guess we're assuming that everybody knows Bret Hart. That's why.
Yeah, but like, I don't mean we need to get into, I mean the psychology of what you learned from the documentary about Bret Hart. Yeah. And you talked about his dad, and I think daddy issues is a huge part of what's going on with Bret Hart. And he has that, like, he joined up, you know, his dad owned Stampede Wrestling. He didn't really want to be a wrestler, but he got called on. Daddy was manager, daddy was promoter. And then he basically gets sold wholesale, Stampede Wrestling and the Hart boys all get sold wholesale to Vince McMahon, and Vince McMahon becomes daddy. That's daddy now. And that loyalty he felt to his dad got kind of transferred to Vince.
And he says it out loud.
If you took a shot every time he refers to Vince as a father figure or like a father to him or something, you would
loyalty,
die.
Or talk about loyalty about
him. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's so, and it's honestly like heartbreaking in the sense that I know that Vince is not a good person at all.
No.
And he has
good
loyalty.
People feel emotions too, or bad people feel emotions too.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, it's very weird to see, because you're watching it in real time, right? Him getting the call about, hey, you got to do me a favor. You got to go to WCW. And then, you know, the downward spiral between their relationship to the point where he punches him out. And I cannot fathom, like, this man that grew up with a father figure so maybe abusive, we can say that.
Oh yeah, sure. I mean, Stu Hart, very much old school. He's like both of us saw Iron Claw, right? Iron Claw. He's very much from that era of the shoot wrestling. Now, I will say, the stuff in the dungeon in this,
very weird.
There's a little no-touch master kind of stuff going on here, right? Yeah. Like they're playing it up a little. I don't doubt that when they were kids, he would bring guys
when he was
home
young,
and fuck
them
up. I believe that wholesale. But, like, the recreation for the show and the guy, the big bald guy who's, like, really acting it out.
Oh, yeah, he's really
I was getting a big no-touch master vibe from that one. I was like, okay, all right, calm down, guys.
But it's such a weird dynamic, right? Because I get the aspect of, let's say, if in the dungeon they were like training actual wrestling moves, but all he was doing is just torturing people to the breaking point. And to the point that his kids, like one of his daughters was like, yeah, I was like getting something in the kitchen and you can hear it through the vents, people screaming downstairs. It's like,
it was really more like a toughening. It was more just to like get you ready for how hard being a wrestler is. Like to push you and break you and push you to your absolute limits. You know what I mean? And it's a type of, it's that like whiplash mentality, right? Of like, you can't be great unless you've been tested or whatever.
If there's no adversity, you haven't actually earned your spot.
Right, right. And how can you know if you're really that good if you've never been pushed to your limits and whatever? And, you know, you can't deny the results. There's people who came out, you know, I mean, Bret Hart is an icon for sure, but I don't think that justifies abuse of your children. And I also am I don't like when parents when steal. I don't like when parents steal the childhoods of their children. You know what I mean? And like,
yeah, because it's awesome when it's awesome when it works out and they become millionaires and legends. But that's like 1%,
right? 99% of the rest have their lives ruined. Basically, yeah.
They just have trauma.
They just suffer and have to like do stuff they hate and think that they can never please their parents. And you know what I mean? And it's just, and that sucks. But I did like a lot of the behind the scenes stuff, you know, the old footage of the Hart family. This is the first time I ever saw anything about them. I've watched some other stuff about them after that, you know, produced through the WWE. So it's even a little bit more kiss-assy. That's the one thing I like. I want to mix in a couple of non-WWE docs because they do a lot of pretty decent documentaries, but everything's seen through the lens of the business. So you can't always, everything's got a little bit of sheen to it. Everything's a little fake. Everything's a little bit of a lie. Yeah, it's a little
too perfect.
Right. That's the big reason I chose one of the docs that we're going to watch, because it's like one of the few times they let slip that mask, and it's pretty impressive. It's pretty crazy. But anyway, so I like, you know, we get a little backstory on the Harts and everything and their, you know, their status and what that means. And then Brett's kind of rise through the ranks, and he's, you know, he's a tag team wrestler, and he becomes the kind of top guy almost by default. You know, Hulk Hogan leaves the company, and this is actually made even more explicit in the Dark Side of the Ring. They started getting, I think it ties into that thing you were saying about how he's talking about the Indian fans and going overseas and stuff. They started getting feedback that internationally Bret Hart was like the big dog, and it's because Japanese market stuff really loved the technical wrestling, especially back then. And nowadays, modern wrestling fans know that Japan's a big market, but back then we didn't know anything about that. I didn't anyway, as a kid or anything.
And Vince was,
I knew Vince once was, in a while you'd have awesome Mexican or Japanese wrestlers show up on wrestling, and you'd be like, wow, that guy's cool.
Yeah, but they tend to be like intercontinental champion. Oh, sure, yeah.
I mean, they're always in the first hour of Nitro from, you know, 7 to 8 before the good stuff is going, you know? But that's where the best matches were. But anyway, I didn't know anything, but they started apparently getting information. So when Hulk Hogan left, they were like, well, let's see if we can push Brett as a single star. And it worked. I mean, he was the top guy.
But yeah, Vince famously didn't want Brett or anybody because he was, you know, obsessed with the Ultimate Warriors.
Lex Luger. Vince is a muscle guy. He likes the big boys.
Yeah, so Brett is very important in the sense that without him, we wouldn't have the Shawn Michaels, the Rated R, Edge, or
Chris even Jericho.
Jeff Hardy. Like,
sure.
Eddie Guerrero got his shot, even though he got huge.
I guess you could definitely say that in the modern era, he was the test flight for a smaller, more technical wrestler or of high flyers, you know, guys who didn't have the giant muscle mass of a Hulk Hogan, but, you know, had the technical skill and were, and obviously Bret Hart's huge. He's still like massively physical. You see him working out here, huge chest, huge arms. He looks great in this movie.
You saw the lady hitting on him like, oh, you don't look 40. You look amazing. Yeah. And he's like,
and this is a side thing, but I just love the vanity of wrestlers, because there's one story they were telling on the Dark Side of the Ring, and he's talking about like Sean came in the dressing room and I was just brushing my hair, and I was just like, I love the idea of just like the soft combing of Bret Hart brushing out his locks before he gets ready. It's just made me happy.
Yeah, and so, they actually and they play that conversation. The oh, I swear to God, it wasn't me.
Yeah.
But yeah, the other thing that I wanted to touch on is that obviously I was very little and I wasn't paying attention like I would if I was a grown up, but I was actually shocked at how vitriol the storyline became between like Bret hating America. Like now that it no political blah blah blah, but it felt like a Trump rally.
it was wild
watching that footage.
The when they get into that part where basically Bret turns heel, he has a very natural heel turn. I thought he made a very good heel, very believable. It's like a he reminded me of like a Magneto. He's a guy who has a point. He's bad because he believes in his point so strongly, you know? And I thought that was a good way to go at it with a guy like Bret, whose character is so earnest. And I say character, but Bret Hart the man is very earnest like that. He just, everything is out front. And I think that's part of the problem when we get into talking about the actual screw job is like, he takes himself a little too seriously.
Way too seriously.
Yeah, and like...
Which, you know, it's
earned, it's weird that he lost it's the humility that you need in wrestling, you know? Yeah,
it's earned to a certain degree. Like, he did carry the business for a decade or so, and he did bow out of his contract. So you get the sense that, hey, you owe me this. But at the same time, there's no wiggle room with him at all. Like, he doesn't understand both sides, and that's where you can see if it's not a setup, like why the hand was forced the way that it was, due to the fact that you needed to take away the title. It couldn't be like, because you needed to put over Sean essentially.
Well, and that's like I that's another thing I realized too watching it this time, and kind of like you did the time, like kind of reassessing the timeline and realizing that this was like way into the Sean and Bret. This is like 5 years deep. This was that's probably partly why it had gotten so personal, but it also makes it weird. It's like, come on, man. Like you've lost matches to Shawn Michaels before and stuff. Like what is the big deal? And
I think it's also because it was in Canada.
He makes that his sticking point. But I think what comes out in the Dark Side of the Ring and in that like interview that I was watching is that it really has more to do with Shawn disrespecting him when he was like, hey man, no matter what, I'm going to be a professional in the ring. And Sean was like, well, I'm not going to do that for you. And that, like, that was the sticking point for him. He's like, well, then fuck him. And I'm not going to drop this title. And so he used the Canada thing as a sticking point. But I don't think no matter what, I'll walk away and leave the title. And of course, they were like, sure, of course you want to do that. But no, you don't get to do that. That's not how the business works. And for a little context, which we'll get into in another episode, but the Monday Night Wars are going on, and there was Vince wanted to avoid another Alondra Blaze situation, which is where his women's champion left the company with her title and went on TV on the rival company and dropped her title in the trash. That is not great. You don't want your world champion taking your title to do that. So not that Bret Hart's the kind of guy who would, but Vince was at a point, and that's another thing that I think hindsight has given even Bret, if you see interviews later and the stuff from Dark Side of the Ring and the stuff I watched, he acknowledges much more than he does in this movie the pressure that Vince was under from WCW. The fact that he had no choice. He was getting his ass kicked every single week and he had to do something, and it didn't matter if Bret thought it was disrespectful to the way things have been done for 20 years, he couldn't afford to coddle anybody.
Yeah.
He had to make some really difficult choices. And again, I'm not in the business of like defending Vince McMahon or anything, but.
And it is also wild to think that, always again in hindsight, that all he needed to do was wait them out.
Yeah.
Because they self-imploded so quickly after taking over. But yeah, it's very cut and dry what is happening in terms of for a superstar is forcing your hand, and you need every superstar not named Hulk Hogan note and not named John Cena knows that once the fans are shifting towards another superstar, you need to either put him down or put him over. And if the company is asking you to put him over, you, even if you don't like the guy, you have to put him over.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing too. It's like Bret Hart touts himself as this, like, you know, kind of
savior,
statesman of the business, yeah, and hallmark of, like, but like at the, and when it comes right down to it, he was the one who wasn't doing the traditional thing, which is putting the guy over on your way. If you're leaving the company, or if you're retiring, or if you're moving on to a new territory or whatever, you put over the guy on your way out so that they are the new star. You know, you transfer your credibility to them. It, you know, you can, there are ways it can be done where everybody goes out looking strong, but everybody knows. And the idea that, like, somebody who lived in the business had lost that humility, that, you know, I get it, because it's not like he's the only one who it's happened to, but when I always watch this documentary and, like, kind of, because I saw it probably pretty close to around the time it came out and stuff. And then, I always kind of thought of Bret as a victim, much like he thinks of himself, but more and more you look at it in hindsight, he's as culpable as anyone. You know what I mean? He forced their hand. He literally left them no option. He was never going to give it over, you know?
It's funny because they put the Vince speech as a final nail in the coffin of how WWF fucked them over. But he says it like, Bret screwed Bret. And obviously Vince was, you know, very, very well involved. But to the end of the day, the reason why they had to do that shit show, even if you want to believe the conspiracy theories, it was him, you know. It was the character of Hitman didn't want to give it up. Or if you want to follow the conspiracy theories, or if you want to believe the truth, it was Bret that didn't want to follow along. So it had to be done.
Absolutely.
But the other thing that I loved as well was how the wife just calls every single thing as it is. She's like, why? Vince is gonna fuck you over. They're gonna do, I don't trust them. Why are they doing this? It's like every time she like spoke up, I was like, she knows. But that scene, dude, I was just eating it up when she is just talking down Hunter.
Dressing down Hunter in the hallway like a little kid.
Like a little kid. He's looking down at the ground. He's not even looking at her. And he's like, I swear to God. And she's like, you can swear to God all you want. He's going to strike you down. I was like, damn! She's calling the wrath of God!
In all fairness, I had to laugh a little bit because she's all like, oh, you know, Carmel will come back around and get you. I was like, oh yeah, he ended up real rough, boy. Marrying the boss's daughter and becoming president of the company. Turned out real rough for him. Yeah. So, originally, the whole deal starts, like, he gets an offer from WCW. According to him, he says $9 million over 3 years.
3 years, yeah.
Vince comes back with a counteroffer. It's much lower. It's, I think on Dark Side of the Ring, he says $1.5 million for 20 years. I think he meant $1.5 million a year, but for a 20-year contract.
Yeah.
Which he took. He took it because out of loyalty to the company, even though it was less money. Everybody had been jumping ship. Lots of guys had left. He was going to be the guy who was going to stay and bankrupt the company with his gigantic salary. He's like, hey, man, don't worry. I'll stay here with you as long as I can have more money than anyone. As long as I can have the biggest contract anybody's ever seen.
I mean, depending on what he was bringing in, right? And
that's the thing. So they
merchandise and all that stuff.
And then right around, like, not too shortly after that is when the turn becomes, and Shawn Michaels starts to become the guy. So now you've got Michaels and Stone Cold, the guy, and Bret is getting paid more, but he's bringing in less. He's not the guy selling the tickets. And that's when Vince decides, he's like, go back to W. I can't afford your contract from base. And I believe it. He was getting his ass kicked in the ratings. This is before, you know, early, you know, early DX, Austin had, they weren't winning any Monday nights yet. This is within that 83 week period where WCW won everything. Yeah. This is that era where they were not winning. And I believe
Stone Cold was formed, but it wasn't like in his final form yet.
Right.
And DX was starting to bubble up. The Rock hasn't arrived. Mankind is there, and the Undertaker is still
I would say the final formation of Stone Cold happens the next when he fights Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania, and that's after Brett leaves.
Yep.
So we're right there, but at that time, I believe it that Vince could not keep paying him and all the other wrestlers. I believe it. So he tells him to go back and get his contract, and WCW is going to pay him, and he wants to leave. And like we said, the whole thing breaks down. But like, the relationship between Shawn and Brett had degraded so much at that point, and we see all these the hateful promos, and there's a lot of, I don't know, there's still a lot of back and forth with all the stuff I watch, and how much of it is like, Brett will be like, I told Shawn I was going to go out and say these things, and I would come back and he was hurt when I said them, and he knew I was going to say them and was fine with them, and then and I would come back and his hurt feelings were hurt. And I get the impression that Shawn was just a little, you know, he was immature, he was full of himself, you know what I mean? And I think he started taking things a little personally, and then they both started, and this reality started bleeding in. The stuff Brett was saying was true. He didn't think Shawn was a good role model, and he didn't think he was good for the business, and it made for a good storyline, but it was real, and him going on TV and saying it pissed Shawn off, so Shawn would say some real shit, and blah, 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 you know? But then, like I said, it had gotten so bad that he wouldn't take any deals. So he's like locked in. He won't do it.
It's always weird too, because like they keep hammering in the documentary, like, oh, this is more real than you think. And it's very much true. Like in every business, like there's gonna be relationships where you're willing to work the extra shift for a certain coworker, but you're not willing to do any fucking thing for that coworker that you hate. Yeah. So that's pretty much it. Like I bet if it was Mankind or even Vader or whoever, praised, even Goldust, he praised during the intro, if they were the ones getting the heat from the crowd, he probably would have been more receptive to the idea. But since it was Shawn Michaels, I think even Stone Cold.
It was Shawn Michaels, and it was Canada. Like I said, he stole that and used it as a sticking point. I do believe that it was part of it, though. I don't want to give the impression that I don't think that matters.
Yeah, because he was like so high. It was very weird. I get it. Like he was at the height of his fame during the conversation, but he's like, I cannot walk away not being a hero to these people. And I was like, my dude, you're a performer. I get it. Like, they will understand, I think.
But also, you know that you can lose a match and still go out looking like a badass. That you just did that with Stone Cold. Like, you guys did, like, one of the most iconic double turns in history. And both came out looking strong, even though there has to be a winner and a loser. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like, that can be done. And you know it can be done. And that's the thing I think we talked about. But I do want to get into some of the nitty-gritties just around the kind of, because there's a lot of like, in between the time it happens and the stuff we're watching Dark Side of the Ring, there's a lot of people who came forward now and want to like take credit because this became the biggest story ever in the history of wrestling. Now everybody wants to be in on it, right?
Yeah.
What we know
first nobody did it, now everybody did it.
Yeah. What we know for sure from the documentary, and like from just this documentary, is that Vince McMahon and Earl Hebner were in on it for sure.
Oh, I trust the referee. I already called her. I was like,
yeah, I have that written down. It's like it's part of that earnestness of Bret Hart. He's a little bit naive too, and the idea that Earl Hebner would side with him over the guy who signs his checks, he's got to do what he's got to do. And again. Dark Side of the Ring like resolves that, you know, that they got over that, and they're, you know, he forgave him, and he understands, and Brett understands what the pressure he was under and everything now. And
yeah, Herb cries and everything. I didn't expect that out of him, because I always grew up hating him as a, you know, as his character. And I remember getting my mind blown when his twin came out, his brother.
Yeah. That was the thing I loved about this, was where all the people who did end up knowing something about it or, like, thought they were going to get in trouble bailed out of the arena. Like, Jim Cornette and Earl Hebner are, like, racing to get out of the arena after it happened.
I mean, to be fair, like, Vince supposedly got knocked the fuck out, so I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if Herb could have taken a punch.
And Sean was supposedly in the room when it happened and was crying because he thought he was about to get his, too. And I saw Bret Hart say that in front of Shawn Michaels, and Shawn Michaels did not refute it. So, yeah. We get the documentary wires up Bret, so we get to actually hear him and Vince talking about the match, and we know that it was not, that it was planned. It was going to be a run-in,
though.
From Owen and British Bulldog were supposed to run-in.
I felt it was edited weirdly.
I never ever wanted to leave here with any kind of bad feeling, but this week has been a bad week for me. I feel kind of betrayed a little bit.
Well, I do too, a little bit. And again, all we're talking about really is Ted Turner. That's what's coming between you and me, and that's all. Can't tell you how appreciative I will always be for everything you've done.
I didn't want to leave with any problems. I actually didn't want to leave at all. And then it's the point where there was no other choice but to go. The way this whole thing has been depicted, it's really hard for me as a hero here to come up short this weekend. What would you want to do today, then?
I'm open to anything.
I think what I'd like to do is get through today. I think tomorrow I should just go in and do my speech and forfeit the title. I think it allows me a chance to leave with my head up and leave in a nice way. I mean, I don't have to beat Sean. We could have a schmoz or whatever you want.
I would think it'd be a run-in type thing. But,
yeah.
But I'm open to
anything. No, I think that's...
I'm open to anything. Like I said before, I'm determined this is going to wind up the right way.
Okay.
The sound volumes and noise kind of felt weird. At least
I definitely felt like we didn't get the full conversation.
Yes.
Yeah.
It felt like manipulated a little bit because but at this point the documentary crew already knows we have fucking gold. The WWF is screwing the fuck over of their best star, so you know that they're gonna shift the narrative and edit it in a certain way. I don't doubt that the conversation occurred, and it probably he's like, okay, whatever you want, and maybe Vince was kept like pitching other ideas and kept batting down. But it felt weird the audio. But I agree, like they had the conversation, and he was like,
yeah,
let's just disqualify us, and that would have been a fine ending, I guess, but like you said, he's under pressure and he has to take that belt.
Yeah. And yeah, he doesn't want I don't know. He doesn't want the Bret to get to take the strength of the WWE title, whether he carries the title or not. He doesn't want him to go out without having to take a loss to their champion. You know, wants that.
He's
he wants
always
the top
be the
guy
WWE.
That beat the champion to be in his company.
Yeah.
So he doesn't want to let Bret just go without taking that loss.
Yes. There is this in UFC, there's this thing called the linear champion.
Sure.
And that's when, let's say, Frank Shamrock went to Japan and technically lost, even though he wasn't defending the title. That guy is actually the UFC heavyweight champion. So Bret Hart, if he would have gone to WCW, he would have been eternally the WWF linear champion until he lost at WCW, and then somebody else in WCW is their champ.
Yeah. So, we hear that, like I said, we hear that conversation between Bret. Now, there are at least two, I've heard at least two stories. There's one in Dark Side of the Ring, which is Jim Cornette and Vince Russo sitting with Vince pitching ideas and calling Bret and then calling back, and then he's shooting things down and they're back and forth. And then both Jim Cornette and Vince Russo try to take credit. I kind of would have to lean towards Jim Cornette just because Vince Russo's a known liar and piece of shit. And
I don't think Jim Cornette would take
credit for it if he didn't do it, because I don't think he necessarily is proud of it. You know what I mean? Like,
no,
I mean,
and
he's
also
just telling it like it is.
Yeah, and also Jim Cornette has, like, you know, he's an actual student of the
art of wrestling. Talks about the old screwjob that happened in Montreal, which is a good one, a good story. But
the reason why I believe Jim Cornette over him is because this is not the first time Vince is trying to take credit. Like, he's also he also tried to take credit for the screw job that they did to Hulk Hogan in WCW.
TNA or WCW, yeah.
Yeah, where the guy with the Jeff with the guitar.
Jeff Jarrett, yeah.
Yeah, Jeff Jarrett was supposed to lose the title against Hulk Hogan because Vince Russo didn't want to give it to Hulk, blah, blah, blah. And he convinced Jarrett to just lay down on the ring.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, and so like, supposed
what the fuck is this? He, like, leaves and shit. Yeah, I remember.
And Vince Russo is telling a completely different fucking story. And the guy that ran WCW, I'm blanking his name now.
Eric Bischoff
is like, this fucking dude is a fucking liar. Like, yeah. So two people are calling you a fucking liar on two things that you're claiming. I'm going to lean to the other two that are calling you a fucking liar.
Right. So you have that where basically probably Jim Cornette, but somebody pitches the idea of this kind of screw job element. Yeah. But I've also heard a story, and I wasn't able to track down the actual footage of it. But I 100% remember it. I might have been on a WWE produced Shawn Michaels documentary I watched. It wasn't the A&E biography, though. I know that because I watched some of that. But anyway, it's Vince and Triple H and HBK and Shawn Michaels, HBK. Oh, man, I'm such a fucking mark. Called him HBK. Oh, man, you have to edit that out. That's embarrassing.
I've been saying... Dude, I've been awake since 4 a.m, okay? Uh-huh. I'm barely here right now, so my mistakes are staying in, yours as well.
Fair enough. But either way, I heard there's a story where they were talking about it, and basically Triple H is the one who's like, well, if he won't play ball, then fuck him. You know, then we screw him. And maybe it's kind of a combination of Triple H was the one who was like, put the business over Brett. You know, no more kid gloves. And then Cornette is the one who kind of came up with more of the sweaty details of it that they end up using, you know. But either way,
I have a feeling
bare that minimum we have. I wrote down the people who claim to have known about it, right? You got Triple H and Shawn Michaels, obviously, Earl Hebner, Vince. Gerald Briscoe, who was the booker at the time, and grabs Earl Hebner by the arm. And like, it's weird the way people talk about, I don't want to talk about Pat Patterson, but Pat Patterson and Gerald Briscoe, because they come from that old school era too. And they're like legitimately afraid of Gerald Briscoe. They're like, he grabbed me. Like, Earl Hebner was like, he grabbed me by the arm. He was so afraid. And then they're talking about Shawn Michaels in one of the, in the interview when I was watching, was talking about how, like, Gerald Briscoe was offering to teach him some, like, legit moves in case it came to, like, a physical altercation with Brett. And he was like, if it comes down to it, I'll teach you some actual, like, holds and grapples and stuff. So it's so funny to hear him talk about the guys who were, like, the stooges for Vince McMahon, who were basically, like, a couple of goobers, as though they're, like, legit hard
That's one of the things that also was fascinating. I wrote it down because... I always just, obviously we know the character who Pat was, doing that Monday Night Run, as just being this kiss ass who doesn't do anything. It just follows along Vince. And suddenly the first thing I hear is like, Brett saying, I immediately talked to Pat because he's the one that sees the vision. And I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? Really?
Like, he's one of those guys they talk about who just had like a crazy mind for the business and could like really.
That's fact. I honestly love that aspect because that's one of those, you know, little seeds of information that you would never get if you just follow along with the actual product of the business.
Well, Yusef, unfortunately, because we brought him up again, I'm going to have to give you some more seeds of information about Pat Patterson.
No, he's probably an asshole, but I'm saying...
He like, is. Unfortunately, it's a little bit worse than that even. Now, he got a lot of... Late in his career before he passed away, he got a lot of goodwill because he came out that he was gay, and he was a long time, you know, in the business, closeted, obviously.
Okay.
The guys in the locker room kind of knew, but like obviously nobody out, you know, nobody in society knew at the time.
Yeah.
And you know, obviously lived under this, and so there was a lot of goodwill pouring out to him near the end of his life about that. But there, unfortunately, the things that get covered up is there was also in the '80s there was something known as the Ring Boy scandal. So basically, the WWE would go to these towns and they would hire like 14, 15, 16-year-old boys to help them put the rings up and you know, do little chores around. And I think you can see where I'm going with this. And there was some cover-ups, and I don't believe there was anybody ever got convicted of anything or done anything. Their people were paid and covered up. But unfortunately, that's a thing that I have to know. And I think I have to put that burden on you now as well. Pat Patterson was like one of the key names that was like a part of that.
The older I get, the more I realize that there's always a pedophile.
Yeah.
Right? Like it's
anywhere where adults have access to children, you're gonna find
a pedophile scandal is right there. Boop. It's fucking wild, man.
It's unfortunate. It's unfortunate, very much so. Because I was like you. I was like, how interesting. He was like this. He had this mind for the business and everybody. And then you're like, God, come on, man.
He's a fucking pedophile.
He's a fucking pedo. So anyway, like I said, leading in, we've got, it's still to this day a bit obscure how the idea congealed. Yeah. But it comes to pass.
Yeah, knowing Jim Cornette, knowing Vince, they probably said like 20 different things.
Oh,
meaning
they pitched, but somewhere in there between Triple H being like "fuck him" and Jim Cornette talking about this screw job, somewhere in there, those ideas finally got through to Vince, and he's like, "That's where it lands. That's where I have to go."
Yeah.
So it happens. Classic. It's become such a thing that now other companies have faked screw jobs. You know what I mean? Like the WWE have done like scripted screw jobs now because it's such a well-known moment in history. They talk about it a little bit, and I fully agree. It's definitely, it changed. It's the death of kayfabe as we know it, you know, as far as the actual secretness of the business, the idea. But what they didn't know, what they could have known, what old timers who worried about the death of kayfabe couldn't have known,
it got better.
Was that, it added another element. It added like the back. Now it's like a soap opera where you watch the show and then you read the magazine about the contract negotiations of the stars and how they actually hate each other. And then, you know, it took it on a new life. And so in a way it did. And we talked, but it fully gave birth to the Mr. McMahon character, which much like Bret Hart's heel turn was rooted in a little bit of reality. He really was that maniac who would do anything.
And arguably the most important, character of the entire Attitude Era. Like,
because it could be argued that Stone Cold never would have reached the heights he reached without Mr. McMahon to counterbalance him, you know?
Yep.
They needed each other to fight.
Yeah, or The Rock being that hired gun for him. Like, it's like, he's the catalyst for sure.
And all of that stems from this. There'd be no Mr. McMahon character without the Montreal Screwjob. So it's an incredible moment in the business. We could talk a little bit about the conspiracy that it's a work. They have Shawn Michaels looking on the Dark Side of the Ring. He's watching some footage. First of all, some of that footage he's watching, he's like, look, they zoom in on Vince. They show the loogie. That's footage from the documentary, I think, from Hitman Hart. I don't know if that's WWE footage. He does have a point about them keeping the camera on him while he mimes WCW. That is a little wild. But I don't think that's... I think when we talked about the importance of this documentary specifically, if it weren't for this documentary, for Hitman Hart Wrestling with Shadows, 100% you could convince me this was a work. Yeah. If I had never seen this doc, you could convince me that the Montreal Screwjob was a work. But because of all the behind... It would have to be so intricately planned, so far in advance, and all these little... I just don't know if it could have been done.
No, and also the second argument that they provide, which is fucking ridiculous, which is why you should listen to people that believe in conspiracy theories, because as soon as they start adding elements, because one element can be true, which is this is a work and they wanted to get heat on the WWF before he left. They got it. Perfect. The second element is that Bret Hart was a double agent. And he went in there and he sucked on purpose.
In the to bring down the WCW?
Yeah, to bring down the WCW.
Yeah, that part's like, too dumb. First of all, WCW was well in decline by the time Brett got there.
Yep.
Because he didn't go directly, like, it's not like he showed up on Nitro the next night, I don't think. It was a little while.
Yeah.
And then, and yeah, they were already, like, the fact that, like, his first feud was Goldberg is, like, late-stage WCW. Goldberg is not a
technical wrestler.
Goldberg isn't even prime Monday Night Wars. He's, like, he came in the middle to the end of that stuff. You know, he's like, he was a huge deal, make no mistake, but he was like a later stage thing. He was like, he actually, the NWO had kind of like gotten too big and started to kind of bloat, and the WCW was teetering.
Had like 20 fucking members. And
then Goldberg actually came in and kind of gave them a boost and actually probably gave the WCW a couple more years than it deserved. It should have gone down a little sooner.
No, but and also, like, if you think about Brett, like, why would you put him up? I get it, like, the clash of styles, but why would you put him up against a Bruiser when you had a lot of technical wrestlers over there? Even Sting would have been, he's not the best technical wrestler, but he would have given him far more in-ring work for Brett to go along. Like, I mean, Stone Cold is not the best technical wrestler, but he knew how to sell physicality, and he knew how to sell getting hit. And when I think about Goldberg, he's just always trying to think like I'm indestructible. Like nothing is happening to me.
Yeah, they. It's unfortunate. That's one of the sadder. It's funny, like you know, back when this first came out, I was first watching it around the time. I was sad for Brett because he got screwed. Now I'm way more sad for Brett thinking about his career trajectory after this, because, like, he never really gets back to, like, a lot of guys who go to WCW, despite the fact that the company do get a big second win there, but he didn't even get that. He came in too late for that, and it's a shame he never, you know, Sean got to come back and have a whole second act to his career, and Brett, you know, had that stroke and then couldn't end up really coming back to his soul.
It was a back, right?
Yeah, Sean had hurt his back in like 90. It's like the next year after he has that fight with Stone Cold, and then he has a back issue, so he's out for, and he stays out to like 2005 or something like that. He hasn't come back.
He came back like he lost a lot of like muscle mass. Like he came back like completely different, and then he became a Christian. And he has a lot of arcs.
Yeah,
but
a lot of people, you know. Inarguably, he had like a great second run and like iconic. Yeah. Brett even talks about how seeing his match with The Undertaker was part of what made him like reach out and come back and like want to like. He was just like, it was so good, and seeing him perform at such a high level and just like made me happy, match. You know.
That was a great match for sure.
That's one of the things that bummed me out most about watching it, was thinking that like Bret Hart never got that chance to have a good little final run. Like it didn't have to even be a long one. You know, he didn't need to go. Shawn Michaels came back for like quite a few years. He didn't need to do that. He could have come back and had like one really good feud, and that would have been enough. You know, one good set of matches with Shawn, and then be done. You know,
it had to. If he came back, it would have had to be for sure for Shawn Michaels.
Yeah,
because I mean I get him trying to like start a new feud with, like, let's say Edge, like another Canadian, and they would have done the Canadian angle, whatever the fuck. But yeah, nobody would have cared if it wasn't against Shawn Michaels.
No. Let's see. I'm trying to think if there's anything else we didn't cover. Is there anything you can think of in your notes that we haven't? Any scenes that we didn't, or anything from Dark Side of the Ring that struck you that we didn't get to?
No, I have the wife. I have Trust the Referee, the dungeon, the loyalty talk. Yeah, the loyalty talk. You mentioned it as well. Like him constantly talking about the loyalty to Vince, which was very weird. No, yeah, that's, I have everything covered.
Yeah, well, like I said, I think it's, you know.
Oh, I have one.
Okay.
The mom hating wrestling. That was so fucking funny.
Yeah.
The mom, like, oh, it's going to be 2 years, right? And then her daughters are married, the sons are in the wrestling, like everything is wrestling around her, and she's like just seating in the corner like, fucking wrestling, I hate it.
Yeah, that was really funny. Her, that whole interview was really good.
Well, my parents had 8 boys and 4 girls. All 8 boys got into wrestling, and all 4 girls married wrestlers. Not quite what my mother had in mind.
When we were married, I said to Stu, how long will we be in this business? He said, about 2 years. So 20 years later, I said, Stu, we're still in this. I can't like it. I didn't then, and it's worse now than ever. I said, well, I want the boys in it, any of the boys, and I want the girls marrying wrestlers above all. You know, anyhow, you know, the rest of the story, they're all involved. We couldn't be any into it any more deeply than we are. You know, it's a whole, everything is wrestling.
Yeah, no, I don't think there's anything, like I said, I think looking back, you know, the most interesting parts to me were like kind of like reassessing Brett and like his earnestness, but like to a fault where he like, because he like also, that also like made it so he kind of bought too much into his own character and his own
He didn't, in his head, it bleed into I am Brett the Hitman Hart. Like it, there was no divide in his head between.
He kept talking like the character was somebody different, but he didn't actually feel that way.
Nope.
And like his kind of, it's funny, his pride kind of led to his downfall. But then when I was watching the Dark Side of the Ring, and and they're talking about him coming back, I was thinking about how he talked about wanting to reconcile with the WWE because he doesn't want all the work he did to go unseen. He doesn't want his matches to not be on the channel or on DVD because he is not on good terms with the company or whatever. And so like his pride in his work is eventually what made him kind of reconcile with them.
And obviously he wanted to be in the Hall of Fame, and if you're not in good terms, you're not going to be in the Hall of Fame. I mean, I get it that it's like, it's far more than a job. Like it is definitely a lifestyle. It's definitely a type of brotherhood, and him having cultivated, that's a good point, right? When they were saying goodbye and the wife was like, yeah, I'm saying goodbye, and they're, oh, we're going to keep in touch, but I'm probably never going to see them. My kids grew up around these people.
Yeah, that backstage part before the match really hit home, not only knowing what was going to happen, also like seeing the kids interacting with, like, what I love when Brett's like, go bother the headbangers. I got to talk. Me and Vince got to talk. So go find that. Like, he just sicks his kids on the headbangers and stuff. There was a really weird moment I didn't touch on, but it's in my notes, where they, like, the kid is like in the locker room, kind of like hunkered down, and they like stick the camera right in his face and are all like, is this sad for you? You might never see these. Does this feel weird? And I was like, that's really, that I didn't like that. That felt real like exploitative. Not one of the documentary crew's better moments, but
no, for sure. No, it's like, do you want to cry?
Yeah, but there is a, you know what, honestly though, I got to give it to him. There's a level of ruthlessness to good documentary filmmaking, and they made a pretty solid doc here. This
I was honestly surprised I liked it so much.
Yeah, it's first of all, for how old it is, and it's kind of done in an older style, it's not as like kind of glossy as a modern documentary. But also it really documents a moment, you know what I mean? Like, we're gonna talk about some documentaries that span a little bit more time, and this is a very focused one, you know. This one is like really, and it's a moment that ended up becoming so important to the business. And like I said, I think this documentary kind of single-handedly closes the book on the idea that it's a work. So it's like one of the few defined things in wrestling that you can't refute. You know what I mean? Yeah.
It's like what Jim Cornette says, like the guy that hurled, like that wanted to keep the standard of the business is the guy that killed kayfabe.
It brought it all down. Yeah.
So it is a fascinating aspect to that story.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, man, thank you so much for indulging me. And, you know, we got a little bit more content for you fans of wrestling coming up. Me and Yusuf are going to do a couple more docs and maybe even watch some WrestleMania. Ooh. Yeah, that's right, baby. You want to hear what we think about modern wrestling? You're going to find out. Hey, Winston. Hey, buddy. Oh, we love them, guys.
Do you see it?
Yeah. Is that his little face tumor? Aww. Yeah. Sorry, buddy. Anyway, well, I love you. I love Winston. Thank you for joining me. We can't wait to come back and talk wrestling again with you soon. So join us back here on whatever this show ends up being called. Yusuf will put in our Twitter handles and stuff. They'll come up on the screen. Thanks for watching. As always, any of our content and anything on this channel, leave a review, like, and subscribe. That's what people say, right? No? Gross. Cut that out. Cut it out, Yusuf. All right. Bye.